Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Division 5 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. And we have two matters on the 130 docket and one matter on the 230 docket. The first matter we have today is Citizens for Responsible Growth against RCI. Council table, you're here on that case? Good. And the second case is Schumach, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Against James, and council are here on that case?
Yes.
Very well. We have read the briefs in these cases, and at least one of us has been under the record. We're well aware of the background facts, so you, if you choose to do so, can dispense with that and streamline your presentation. You have 15 minutes aside. When the yellow light comes on, that means 5 minutes remains. And for the appellant, if you would like to reserve time, you may do so at that point for rebuttal. I would ask the people in the audience and the council table, if you have pagers or cell phones, if you would please turn those off so we're not disturbed during the oral arguments. And with that request, council, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jack Reutzel. I represent the appellant RCI in this matter. This case involves a challenge of three separate land use applications approved by the Elbert County Board of Commissioners for property my client intends to develop. We're going to try to attack this in two sort of different arguments. First, we believe the complaint was filed too late under Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure 106B, should be dismissed. Because the point of administrative finality in Elbert County occurs at the announcement of the decision after the public hearing in accord with 3 bar J. Additionally, and in the alternative, the Board of County Commissioners relied on competent evidence in the record in deciding the three cases, and their decisions should be upheld. With regard to the timeliness issue, the district court ruled with regard to one of the land use applications, the preliminary plat, that there were 15 conditions of approval. There in the written resolution, there was 14. Using his reading of Wilson versus Board of County Commissioners of Weld County, he determined that was a revision. We argued in our opening brief that that was too broad a brush that he painted with, because there were two other applications with separate findings of fact, separate conditions of approval that got caught up in that same decision. There were no differences between the conditions articulated on the evening of January 4th with regard to the rezoning and the written resolution, nor was there any difference between the conditions of the 1041 permit announced orally on January 4th and the written resolution. The condition that the court focused on, in our mind, really wasn't a revision. It was an understanding that condition 14, to submit a draft subdivision improvement agreement had in fact been met. It had already been fulfilled. It was fulfilled the night of the hearing on the record. Everyone in the audience knew about it. So at that point, it was superfluous to have kept it in a resolution. We do not consider that to be a change.
Mr. Reutzel, wouldn't the Wilson case suggest, so long as there's just a clerical change, if it's reduced to a written order, no matter how slight that clerical change might be, that's really the final matter?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe Wilson cites a very narrow exception to the general rule that the point of administrative finality occurs at the night of the hearing. What Wilson said is that you have to look to the date of adoption of the revised resolution. That's what Wilson says. Citizens argue that Wilson should be read to expand the date of the resolution to actually the recordation of the date. They gave that argument on page 20 of their brief. Going back to your question, we think that the facts of the Wilson case are different than the facts of the Elbert County case. We hold Wilson to be a narrowly tailored case based on the specific facts found in Wilkes County. In Elbert, there is no requirement for a writing of any kind, clearly not a requirement for a recordation of a resolution. To hold that then any change to something that's not required, there's no process, there's no certainty, is too burdensome. Citizens, the appellees in this case, argued in their answer brief that really it wasn't the revision that they were after at all. Indeed, it was simply the fact that there was a writing, and that then told the time for 30 days because they hadn't the board hadn't reached their administrative finality yet. As I mentioned, Wilson is a narrow exception to a different set of facts, and I think it is applicable to those jurisdictions that require such a writing. Second, citizens' proposition to require a writing where none is required creates great uncertainty as to when the point of administrative finality is reached. We have a great deal riding on administrative finality for the government, for interested citizens, and the developer. That's why the 30-day window is so tight. We need to be able to get on with with further investments or appeal rights to keep extending the time, certainly up to a point where an event that isn't required under the code creates tremendous uncertainty and I think an unfairness to all parties. The whole idea of the 30-day is that we have to have a clear understanding of what was decided, when it was decided, so that the world essentially knows. As I said, Wilson said it's the date of adoption of the revised resolution, and citizens argued that really what they need is they need not the adoption, but the recordation of that resolution.
What was the date of the adoption of the written resolution here?
The only evidence that we have in the record is it was contemporaneous with the hearing on January 4th. It says so in the face of the resolution. Unlike Wilson, where there is also evidence of a different signing date of the resolution, there is no such signing date here. Based on the evidence in the record at the time, that's the date. Citizens provide no case law in support of this expanded finding or expanded ruling they're asking you to make for Wilson. To use that as the general rule here, where now it's the recordation of a resolution, again, creates great uncertainty as to when the 30 days starts to run, because the recordation of a resolution is not anything the BOCC decides on. It's not a requirement. They don't control the recording. It's left to the clerk and the clerk and recorder's office. Depending on the backlog, it may be days, it may be weeks before a resolution is recorded. To require that be the date that a 30-day notice begins to run seems completely unfair, especially since there's nothing in the code that requires it. So there's no procedure. There's no requirement that you mail the notice of recordation to any of the parties. So you're constantly having to guess or to figure out or to bother the clerk or recorder's office to see if it's been recorded. That to me is an unfair standard and creates great uncertainty. These missteps are not a reason to impose requirements on Elbert County inconsistent with its regulation. The fact that they missed the 30 days from the point of administrative finality that was articulated on January the 4th at the hearing. The board had the resolution before them. They read in the findings of fact. They read in the conditions of approval for all three land use applications. They missed the date on the resolution that was coterminous with the oral decision by the board. They missed the decision published in the newspaper a week later saying this matter was final. In fact, they have to get you to agree that it's the date of recordation because they've missed every other deadline. Their missteps should not be a reason to expand Wilson to include a date of recording as the.
Mr. Roy, so would you spend some time talking about the master plan and your position that it's advisory?
Certainly, I was just getting into that. And turning now to the merits of their complaint. It's well settled in Colorado that the Board of County Commissioners' decision in quasi-judicial matters should be given great deference. If there's any evidence in the record to support what the Board of Commissioners did, courts are bound to uphold that. And so it's a very tough standard for the citizens. Master plans are advisory only in Elbert County. It's never, the master plan has never been adopted as a regulation by the board, unlike other jurisdictions where, like La Plata County, where Condeotti comes from, they adopted the land use plan as a significant portion of a permit system where you got points if you found compliance with the master plan. Elbert County never has adopted it, and therefore, as to them, it is an advisory document. The Condor case that citizens rely on, we believe, is legislatively overturned. The Condor case came down in 1996. The next legislative session, 1997, the state legislature stepped in and made a very clear, simple statement in the statute that said master plans for counties are advisory only.
Is there anything in the legislative history that indicates that there was a specific discussion of the Condor case?
There wasn't anything that I could find during my briefing. I just look at the dates, the date that the Condor decision came down, that the next legislative session, and this statement that really steps back in time and makes the role of master plans advisory as it was up until the date of Condor. And the whole line of master plan cases dating all the way back to Theobald, it was determined that master plans are advisory. Condor was the first case where they actually talked about a two-pronged test. State legislature, in my mind, didn't like that, came back the very next session and made it clear that it was they were advisory.
If we were to assume for a moment that is not a legislative overruling of Condor, the new statute, would you agree that basically the same regulations were present in this case as were present in Condor, that they were relied on by the majority there to find a legislative?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor, but the facts that are apparent in Elbert County with regard to the master plan suggest that the master plan was one of several criteria to be considered by the board in reaching its decisions on the three separate land use applications. There was evidence in the record to support that the board's findings that each of these land use applications was consistent, was in the record, and it was competent evidence, and the board therefore had the right to rely on it. Whether or not the board could have taken a provision of the master plan and sought to elevate it to a standard is left to the board. They chose not to do that with regard to the master plan here. Within the regulatory context of Elbert County, the planned unit development process is given great deference to development. It's not uncommon in jurisdictions throughout the state. PUDs are looked at as a way of anticipating and encouraging innovative development. The PUDs are given great deference in that the code allows them to vary certain land use parameters from the zoning code. One of those parameters that they're allowed to deviate from is the density. And this project was a PUD. With regard to the water, the other argument, substantive argument, I'd like to remind the court that this argument only affects the 1041 permit, not the rezoning application and not the preliminary plat. The Board of County Commissioners, again, relied on testimony from the applicant, the applicant's engineer, and the planning director in concluding that this was a renewable source capable of applying the 100-year rule. The county has no definition of what a renewable source is in the county, so the Board of County Commissioners were required to listen to the evidence, apply as best that they can, and based on the evidence, come up with a determination. That's exactly what the board did. Therefore, it is our position that the complaint was filed too late and that there was competent evidence in the record to support the decision on the merits. I have 2 minutes and 10 seconds. I would like to reserve that for rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Roysel.
Thank you. May
May it please the court. My name is Joe Dischinger. I represent the appellees in this case, Citizens for Responsible Growth, as well as Laura Shapiro and John Dorman. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. At the beginning, I'd like to raise the issue of some post-briefing motion that I filed. I moved to strike some of the arguments raised by the appellees, all three of which have been raised again here in oral argument, and received a ruling saying that the court would defer decision on that motion to strike until oral argument. But my point was all of the arguments that I mentioned in that motion were things that could have been raised long ago and were raised for the first time in their reply brief. For example, the appellants alleged in their reply brief and again at oral argument that Wilson is distinguishable because there's a requirement in Weld County for resolutions of this type to be in writing. Whether I may talk about the facts in Weld County depends on whether the court will strike those arguments. So,
Mr. Dischinger, when matters are deferred to the Merits Division, the Merits Division will, in fact, deal with them. Depending upon the nature of the motion, we often will not issue a ruling until we issue a formal written opinion.
I see. All right.
It's probably best here if you go ahead and make your arguments.
Okay.
But we assure you that we'll consider it.
All right.
Well, the opinion issues.
And I apologize, Your Honor, for the procedural diversion, but I actually do have more information about exactly what happened in Wilson, which I think is extra record and ordinarily would not be appropriate. But if the court is going to consider their arguments, then I'd like to also mention that I've determined that the so-called revision that occurred in the Wilson resolution was the staff of Weld County had made a recommendation about whether or not to approve the applications at issue in the Wilson case. They had submitted a statement to the board with that recommendation, and the statement said, staff recommends blah, 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 staff is concerned that blah, 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 blah. They issued the written resolution, and the written resolution changed all of those references to staff to the board, the board concludes blah, 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 the board is concerned blah, 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 blah. They found out they missed one of those changes. So the revised resolution went back to change a reference to the staff is concerned that to the board is concerned that. It was not a significant revision. And it was not, more importantly, it was not a revision of any decision that was made orally. And it was never an issue in the Wilson case that the time for appeal ran from the time of the oral decision. The question was, does it run from the first written resolution or the second written resolution? The court said, we don't care how minor the revision is, it runs from the revision. But I think it's, you know, I think it's disingenuous for the appellants to argue that Wilson turned on this question of whether or not you had to have a written resolution in order for a decision to be final. There's no basis in the decision for drawing that distinction. The appellants also argued about the need for finality. And this case is an example of why that is really not an issue. In this case, the citizens who were my clients found out about the fact that a written resolution had been done. And we relied upon that fact in determining when our Rule 106 appeal was due. There wasn't any uncertainty in our mind about when it was due. If you don't know that a written resolution has been done or is going to be done, the better practice would certainly be to file your Rule 106 action within 30 days at the time of the oral announcement. In this case, we did know. And it's certainly going to be a bigger problem for citizens groups than it is going to be for developers, this issue of finality. Developers are in constant communication with the staffs of the counties that they are trying to get their applications through. They know if a written resolution is going to be done. The applicants in this case knew a written resolution was going to be done. They talked about the fact that it was read at the public hearing, and you can be sure that they were in constant communication with the staff to find out when the written resolution was signed. Council also said the only evidence in the record as to when that resolution was signed is the statement in the resolution itself that it was done at the time of the public hearing. That's actually not what the written resolution says. It refers back to the fact that a public hearing occurred on a certain date. It does not say that it was that the resolution was signed on that date. And in fact, in our complaint in this case, we alleged that that the signing of the written resolution did not occur at the public hearing or on that date. It occurred sometime later. And the response of both RCI and of the Board of County Commissioners was that they were without knowledge sufficient to form a belief as to the truth of that allegation. Now, if anybody should know whether or not that allegation was true, then the Board of County Commissioners certainly should. And I would think also RCI should. They did not deny the factual allegation that it was signed after January the 4th. They simply said, we don't know when it was signed. So I think the evidence is that the resolution was signed sometime after January the 4th. Now, another argument that we raised in our motion to strike was that this whole issue of whether the time for appeal should run from the time the written resolution is signed as opposed to the time that is recorded, that's another argument that was raised for the very first time in their reply brief. We've been litigating this issue for a very long time. We have never argued that as a general proposition, it should run from the time the written resolution is recorded. We were forced into the position of making that argument because we asked the county when the written resolution was signed and they wouldn't tell us. So we were left with no option but to assume that it was signed on the day that it was recorded.
Mr. Dissinger, is your argument dependent on the fact that the written resolution was revised?
No.
So you think it should run from the written resolution regardless of a revision?
I do. And that is because what we're trying to determine is when was the county done with its decision. That's what Wilson is about. When were they finished? And if they were finished at the public hearing, there would have been no need to sign a written resolution. Or if they were really finished and the written resolution was done, sign the written resolution right there at the public hearing. They made a lot of changes to the written resolution during the course of that hearing, and they read those changes into the record. They could have also entered into the record this one condition that is currently in there. It's going to be removed because that condition's already been met. They didn't do that. I don't know why they didn't do it, but they didn't do that. We've got word processors now. It's very easy to spit out another resolution that takes out a condition that's already been met and have it signed right there by the Board of County Commissioners at the public hearing. They didn't do that. My clients were preparing to file their Rule 106 action within 30 days of that public hearing until we found out that they had come out with a written resolution. And then we said, okay, well, it must not have been final when they announced it at the public hearing because they thought they needed to do a written resolution. So we're going to run the 30 days from that time. And I think that's clearly what Wilson holds, so it would be unfair to my clients to impose a new rule at this point. Therefore, I just want to reiterate the point that it was not a series of missteps by Citizens for Responsible Growth that led to our decision about when to file this action. It was a conscious decision based on case law. We cited the Wilson case in our complaint to make it clear that that's what we were relying on. So it wasn't a misstep.
Do we have a situation where if we don't know the date of the written resolution, and your argument is that it's the date of the resolution rather than the recording that controls, that we have an unresolved fact issue that would have to be addressed by the trial court?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's the situation because we asked at the time when was this signed, and they wouldn't tell us. To now allow them to come back and say, oh, it was signed 2 weeks before the resolution was recorded, would penalize my clients. If they had simply told us what the date was, we would have run 30 days from that date, and we would have been fine. But they wouldn't tell us. They shouldn't be rewarded for playing hide the ball from my clients and then letting the 30 days run. And incidentally, I do not want to argue for the general proposition that all Rule 106 actions should run from the time of recording. But I will point out that the whole purpose of recording is to provide certainty and finality and to prevent situations where the county plays games with people by not recording a document until 30 days have already elapsed and then recording it so that people can see exactly what the final decision was. Mr. Reutzel mentioned that the board could have elevated the requirement to comply with the master plan to a requirement, but it chose not to do that in this case. Now, first of all, of course, it's our argument that through the zoning regulations, the subdivision regulations, and the 1041 regulations, they have already elevated the provisions of the master plan to a requirement. And I just want to remind you that the provisions of those three regulations, which were adopted by the Board of County Commissioners, require compliance with the, quote, requirements, close quote, of the master plan. It doesn't require, you know, compliance with the advisory suggestions of the master plan if the board decides that it wants to do that. They have already announced it in the regulations that these are requirements. I also want to respond to Mr. Reutzel's argument that because this is a planned unit development, or PUD, basically all bets are off with respect to the density requirements in the master plan. There is a provision of the planned unit development regulations in Elbert County, Part 2, Section 16, Paragraph B5, which says, the minimum lot area, and by the way, these are general requirements for planned unit developments. It says the minimum lot area, front yard, side yard, and rear yard requirements of the zone in which the planned unit development is located may be varied, provided that the gross density of the development is within the land use area guidelines referenced in the master plan. So the master plan, the PUD regulations themselves require that any deviations from density have to be within the land use area guidelines referenced in the master plan. So they have certainly elevated this. Now, I also think it's a mistake to get too hung up on the notion that what we're saying is the master plan itself is a binding document in all respects. That's not what Condor and Condiati say, and that's not what we're saying. What it says is if the county requires through regulations consistency with the master plan, and the requirements of the master plan are sufficiently specific to allow everyone to understand exactly what is required, then that provision of the master plan can be binding. That's exactly what we're arguing here. The density requirements in this case are extremely specific, and with the density bonuses that are allowed under the master plan, it is permissible for this development to have a housing density of one house for every 1.88 acres. That's not an ambiguous standard. And the developer understood what that was. The county planning department understood what that was. We understand what that was. To say that there's competent evidence in the record that we complied with the density requirements is disingenuous, because it's not something that requires any real analysis to determine whether or not it's consistent. If it's above 1.88 houses per acre, it doesn't comply. And that's the situation in our case. The same argument can be made with respect to the renewable source of water argument under the 1041 regulations. Yes, there's no definition of renewable source of water, but renewable is one of those words that I think everybody understands. It means that it is a source that will be renewed. It will be replenished. And there's plenty of evidence in the record cited in my brief that the water from the Denver Basin aquifers is not going to be replenished. It's going to expire at some point. And The issue in this case is, are we going to allow it to expire in 100 years? Are we going to allow it to expire in 300 years? But at some point, that water is going to be gone. And the regulations say, in that situation, we really want to encourage you to find a renewable source of water. They haven't done it in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dischinger. Mr. Reutzel, you have 2 minutes and 7 seconds. 10 seconds. Close.
Close. It is a brave or gutsy play to wait for a writing to toll a 30-day time limit that is jurisdictional. In a jurisdiction that doesn't require a writing, certainly doesn't require a recordation. The date of recording has never tolled a 30-day time limit under 106B. They relied on that date at their peril. Recordation is in the hand of a third party. It isn't something left to decide by the Board of County Commissioners. If you look at 3J versus McMurray, the test is the thing complained of done? Is there anything left to decide? This was not a decision that could be made by the Board of County Commissioners.
The thrust of the argument today seems to be that it's not the recording date, it's actually the date of adoption of the written resolution.
Right.
What's your response to my question about whether we really have a record to answer that question, the date?
I tend to agree that perhaps there is some holes, but we can fashion a fairly articulate argument here. If you take the 30 days, which is the time limit, they waited until the 30th day of recordation before they filed. So that means if this thing was announced or signed anywhere between January the 4th, that evening, up until the day before the recordation, they would still be too late. They would be anywhere from 1 to 11 days too late. So the only way that their case hangs together is if they could show conclusively that it was signed and recorded the same date. They haven't been able to do that, and so I don't think that applies. The master plan criteria cannot be held that you have to find consistency with the 20 some odd goals and 146 policies of the master plan as the appellant urges, as the appellee urges. It's just too hard of a standard. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Reutzel. Thank you, Mr. Dischinger. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.
Thank you.